Welcome to my software quality podcast. My name is Randy Rice, consultant and principal trainer at Rice Consulting Services in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Today we're going to have an interview with Dr. Rebecca Staten-Reinstein, president of Advantage Leadership, as we discuss Dr. W. Edwards Deming and his impact on quality worldwide. But before we get to the interview, I'd like to discuss some software quality in the news. This was an article that was published on Wednesday, February 27th, 2008, from the Associated Press. And it goes back to discuss the stock exchange, Dow Jones Stock Exchange fall of about 416 points that happened, if you remember, exactly a year ago from February 27th, 2008, back on February 27th, 2007. Well, the news article is titled "Computer Glitch Shown as Factor in Market Turmoil." There's that word glitch again that I really don't like. But anyway, the article goes on to describe that many of those details about the stock market fall in documents obtained by Associated Press show that there is a broader technological breakdown than previously acknowledged by Dow Jones and Company, who's the creator of the Dow Jones average on the New York Stock Exchange. And basically, these letters explain what happened during that event. They were requested by the House Financial Services Committee and were released recently by Representative Deborah Price, Republican of Ohio. Now, just to recall what happened on that day, February 27th, 2007, the Dow ended the day down 416 points, or 3.29%, at 12,216.24. But at one point, at the worst level, it was down 546 points, or 4.3%. Now, if you remember about what was on the news at that time, there was talk about that this was some kind of software flaw, some kind of software defect that had happened, and many of the analysts, I remember in particular Jim Cramer on CNBC saying that it's not the market itself that's falling, it was basically a miscalculation by the computers, and it gave the illusion of something much worse happening than really happened. And that's actually confirmed by this story, that it turns out that part of the Dow's drop turned out to be not a decline, but a miscalculation. And according to the Dow Jones account to Congress, that because of high volume that day, there was a data checking program on the company's financial information distribution system that became overwhelmed. And on that, there was a server that was overwhelmed that delivered the real-time trade data used to calculate the Dow Jones index levels. And so that meant that the readings of the Dow were delayed and therefore misleading, beginning about 12:50 p.m., but the discrepancy was not caught until about 1:20 p.m. Now, at roughly 3 o'clock, 2:56 to be exact, Dow Jones employees flipped on a backup system which wasn't running the data checking program. And at 1:59 p.m., the Dow's calculation caught up with the previous trades, but then that resulted in a 170-point fall instantaneously. In the letter that Dow Jones wrote to Congress, it promised that they would create an early warning system to alert about any problems with the real-time feed of data that it uses to create the indexes. So really, it sounds like the root cause there was actually a performance issue. But anyway, in their letters, Dow Jones downplayed the significance of the breakdown that day, and they said that it didn't really cause any damage to investors. It says Dow basically said it was a news item created by the editors of the Wall Street Journal and not a listed security, and it said it received no complaints from the licensees of its indexes. Well, I'm not really sure about all of that. All I know is that it caused a big panic that day, and I'd always heard that there would be some kind of safeguard in place to prevent a major drop in stock prices, or in other words, a major stock market crash. But anyway, that was kind of an interesting event here in the U.S. I realize many of you listen to this podcast from other countries, And so you may have no idea what I was just talking about. But anyway, for those of us here in the U.S., a real-life situation about how software defects can affect us on a daily basis. Now, a couple of items, too. On my blog recently, I put out a posting there of a couple of folks that we've lost recently in the software or in the quality industry. And just wanted to mention them briefly. The first I'll mention is Roger Drabek. Roger was a, I'm not going to say he's a close friend, but I consider him to be a good friend. Met Roger back in 1989. At my first QAI conference, and he was one of the speakers, and he was one of the very first people that I actually heard speak on the topic of software quality, and had a big impact on me. And later, as I was chair of the QAI conference, he was very helpful in the roles of speaker and track host and such, and just a really great guy. And he passed away in the last week of February, I believe, and we're really going to miss him. Details are once again out on my blog at randallrice.blogspot.com. And the other notable passing here is Dr. Joseph Juran, who passed away at the age of 103. Dr. Juran, as well as Dr. Deming, who we're going to discuss in more detail in this podcast, was foundational in the worldwide quality movement. In fact, to give you an idea, you know, a lot of people hold up Dr. Deming as one of the big quality gurus. Well, Deming quoted Juran quite a bit. And one of the interesting points of trivia, perhaps, about Dr. Juran was he was the guy that coined the 80-20 rule. Now, as the Pareto principle, and obviously, Pareto, an Italian economist, published and talked about this much earlier than Dr. Juran, but even in the late 30s, I believe, when Dr. Juran was teaching on this, he was the one that really brought the 80-20 rule to light and how it would apply to other things. And so he was an amazing man and even was working on another book at the time of his death, taking care of his wife, Sophie, of over 80 years of marriage, and That just a fantastic lifespan, and both of these men fantastic lives lived, and we're going to miss them both. Now, going to talk a little bit about our interview that's coming up here. Let me kind of set this up for us in a bit. One of the things that I'm seeing more and more as I teach about software quality, software testing, and all the things that I go around the country talking about is sooner or later in the conversation, it's hard for me to say anything without referring back to the things that Dr. Deming taught. More and more people are starting to ask me, well, who was Dr. Deming? And then I started realizing that we have a whole generation of quality practitioners, either software testers, software QA analysts, all kinds of folks, who really weren't around when the quality revolution of the late 80s and early 90s happened. I was going through some articles, just doing some filing the other day, and I happened to run across an article by my friend, Dr. Rebecca Staten-Reinstein, called The Need Has Never Been Greater to Apply Dr. Deming's 14 Points. And I read the article, and it just really hit a chord with me that, you know, these are the kind of things that, yeah, we really need to be keeping in mind as we do what we do in software quality. Now, the thing about Dr. Deming is, to me, one of the big things is that he was all about business. He wasn't a quality guru for the sake of being a quality guru. He was basically ignored in the United States, and Rebecca's going to give us his background, so I'm not going to get a lot into that. But in the late 40s and early 50s, as the rebuilding of Japan after World War II was going on, Dr. Deming was over there, and he found an audience that was willing to listen on how to improve quality. And so one of the things that kind of coalesced, I guess, out of Dr. Deming's work was what's known as the 14 points. Now, we're going to refer to the 14 points in the interview, so I thought I'd go ahead and read through those. And I'm not going to make a whole lot of comments about these, But I am going to go through the 14 points, so at least you'll be a little bit familiar as to what they are. And by the way, these are in Dr. Deming's book, Out of the Crisis, as well as many other publications. And so if you haven't read anything by Dr. Deming, we're going to talk about that in the interview, too, some of the books that you can read. So point number one is to create constancy of purpose for the improvement of products and services. In other words, the job never ends, and we need to have a mission statement of what we're doing. Point number two is to adopt the new philosophy. The idea here is that it's the customer that really defines quality, and does it do what they want to do, and do we have a mindset to do this? Point number three is to cease dependence on mass inspection. In other words, you can't test everything, and especially you can't inspect everything or test everything at the end of when you build it. Point number four was to end the practice of awarding business on price tag alone. Point five is to improve constantly and forever the system of production and service. This is where Deming's plan, do, check, act cycle came in, and in fact, he referenced that from Walter Schuchart. Point number six is to institute training. Make sure everyone has training on the things that they do. Point seven is to institute leadership. Everyone needs to be on board. Everyone can be a leader from where they're at, but there needs to be a vision as well. And this is where we get the fact that quality and quality improvement has to come from the top down. Point number eight is to drive out fear. This is an organizational thing, and people need to be doing what they're doing because they like to do it, they see the bigger picture, they see the bigger purpose, and that they have the freedom to be critical of things or to at least suggest improvements. In some organizations, people are simply afraid to even suggest an improvement. Point number nine is to break down barriers between staff areas. Point 10 is to eliminate slogans, exhortations, and targets for the workforce. Don't rely on posters, buttons, and balloons, in other words. And if there was anything that we really got wrong with total quality management and the things that Dr. Deming taught, it was that one. There were just so many times where people just made this into a big event and slogans and posters. We totally got that one wrong. Number 11 is to eliminate numerical quotas. They're misleading, and they tend to make people just do more in a shorter period of time, take shortcuts, and basically one of the best things you can do to have low quality is to have quotas. Point 12 is to reduce or to remove barriers to pride of workmanship. Let people put their names with things. Let people be associated with the work they do, and also make sure that the processes are there. That is the process that typically fails, not the people. Point 13 is to institute a vigorous program of education and retraining. And so just a one-shot effort at training is not enough. Some people say, well, we'll be trained 2 days a year whether we need it or not. And it's not just a push one time a year. It's constant training, and whether it be in a formal training program or reading a book, never stop learning and educating yourself. And point 14 is take action to accomplish the transformation. You may not realize it, but if you're in the QA field, and even if you're just a part of a team, your role is a change agent. You can be a factor in asking people, are we doing the right thing? Are we doing things that move us closer to or further away from our mission? So those are the 14 points. Now we're going to go ahead and go to our interview with Dr. Rebecca Staten Reinstein. Just a word about her. She's president of Advantage Leadership and helps IT and QA become more aligned with their businesses to improve bottom line results. And Dr. Rebecca, as she likes to be called, is a longtime quality practitioner, manager, and consultant, and the author of Get Great Requirements, Create Solutions Customers Want, The Hard Job of Making Software Work, Establishing Quality Assurance Step by Step, and finally, Success Planning, a How-To Guide for Strategic Planning. Now, her forthcoming book is Conventional Wisdom, 11 Lessons Business Leaders Can Learn from the Founding Fathers. And you can reach Rebecca at www.advantageleadership.com or at rebecca@advantageleadership.com. So now we're going to go to the interview.
Well, today I'm interviewing Dr. Rebecca Staten-Reinstein, a friend from the past. We've known each other for quite a while. And we're going to talk with her today about Dr. Deming and his work and also what it means for companies in the United States, not only manufacturing, but especially software and what we do in software. So, Rebecca, it's great to have you with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, so it's been a while since we've spoken, but before we get into Dr. Deming a little bit, let's talk a little bit about what you're doing these days. I understand that you're writing a new book.
Yes, I am. It's in the area of strategic planning, and we interviewed 21 CEOs, and we did not pick them at random. We took people who already we understood had both vision and the ability to execute on that vision, to make it happen. And we based the book on the U.S. Constitutional Convention of 1787, and we weaved back and forth between the what they were doing in the 18th century and how the Constitutional Convention was actually a strategic planning session, and then what our modern leaders are doing. It's very similar. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, interesting. Well, we'll have you back on as a guest when the book is finished, and I understand it's not going to be too much longer.
No, we've got a publication date of June 28, 2008.
Super. Well, we'll have you back on then, and we'll talk more about some of the neat stuff in the strategic planning that you're into. Well, the reason that we're talking with Dr. Rebecca today is because I was doing something very much needed this past week. I was cleaning out my office, and I ran across this article that you had written back in October of 2005 for the QAI Journal, and the article was The Need Has Never Been Greater to Apply Dr. Deming's 14 Points. And it really caught my eye because I've been doing some writing in the newsletter recently, in my Software Quality Advisor newsletter, and as I've been conducting training classes, I've been trying to bring out some of the work of Dr. Deming again, and I'm learning that it's amazing that we have so many new people in the profession of software quality, I guess in quality in general, that many of them haven't heard of Dr. Deming, or if they have, they're not really very aware of what he did. Could you kind of give us your maybe 90-second to 2-minute introduction on Dr. Deming? If someone was to ask you in a class, who is this guy and what did he do, could you kind of give us a thumbnail sketch bio of him?
Sure. W. Edward Deming was born in 1900 and died in 1994. And for most of those 94 years, he was out there proselytizing for quality. He invented the modern quality movement. He based his work initially on the work of Dr. Schuchart, who invented statistical process control, applying the new science at that time of statistics to mainly manufacturing processes. But what we've understood since then is that you can apply it to any process, including software development, software testing. And Deming was instrumental during World War II in getting the U.S. manufacturing structure focused on quality and using his techniques and approaches to create war material, which needed to be top quality. After all, you don't want to find out on the battlefield that your gun doesn't work, that your tank won't run. The Japanese adopted him after World War II when he went there to work as part of the reconstruction project, and he became very close with many of the most important Japanese industrialists who took on his notions of continuous improvement and statistical process control, and they applied them. They took them to heart. They said, this is good stuff. And he told them, this is how you're going to rebuild your country. Meanwhile, back in the USA, after World War II, interest in quality died out. And so Deming, although he spent many years as a professor, ended up at Columbia, was not particularly noticed here until the Japanese products began to displace the American-made products. And in 1980, he was rediscovered on a TV show in which he talked about what he had done and how his contribution to the Japanese comeback. And companies got interested. Ford, Motorola were two of the top companies that called him up right away. And with that, their modern quality movement was born, and people called it TQM, or Total Quality Management. But in the early 90s, even that began to die out. Companies got interested in other things, and so since that time, you never hear anything more about TQM. In fact, people have heard of it, said, oh, you know, that's old-fashioned, we don't do that. But quality never really goes away. It always kind of evolves. I think of it as walking up a spiral staircase, and you come back to the same place, but you're at a little higher level. And essentially, the modern quality movement, as it exists at all today, exists in two initiatives. One is called Six Sigma, and the other is called ISO 9000-2000. And in both of them, Dr. Deming's ideas and principles are the foundation and underpinning of those.
Uh-huh.
Those are the notions of continuous improvement and plan, do, check, act. And so if you look at the things that hold up those movements, it's really Dr. Deming.
Okay. Well, that's a great introduction, Rebecca. And, you know, one of the things that I found interesting from the story of Deming's time in Japan was that they wanted him to do another seminar series over there, but he didn't do it. He felt like that the leaders had to take ownership and to convert it to make it their own, I guess. And so I kind of see the same thing here in the U.S. that you know, it seems like it's corporate management that really has to get ownership of quality. They're the ones that, it seems, as Deming would say, to adopt the new philosophy. Is that what you see in doing work with companies?
Yes. In fact, if Deming was very clear about this. He refused to work with anybody except the top managers and, you know, with the executives and so forth. And because he understood very clearly, if it is not led from the very top, from the CEO on down, if this doesn't become a major part of the commitment and the mission of the company, then it peters out.
Uh-huh.
You can have these little improvement teams going on way down in the bowels of the organization, and you can have champions running around saying quality is cool stuff. But at the end of the day, if the CEO is not focused on it, it's not going to happen. It's not going to make its way into the budget. It's not going to make its way into the schedule.
Uh-huh.
And it's not going to be seen as a priority. It's going to be seen as nice to have, something we do if we have time, but today's mantra is more with less, and we don't have the time, we don't have the money, just ship it.
Yeah, you know, and it's kind of funny, one of Deming's 14 points, you know, to eliminate slogans.
Yes.
For those of us who are working in the time of TQM and when a lot of these ideas were being embraced here in the U.S., we broke that one, didn't we?
Oh, yeah.
I think there were probably some companies that made a living off of the slogans, off of the posters and the buttons and the other things. But it kind of, my observation was is that it needs to be something stronger than management support. You know, it probably needs to be, you know, it's management leadership or something.
Yes, yes.
Well, where do you think we lost it as a I know it's kind of nebulous to say as a country, but maybe as a mindset in our country or something, do you know if there was a specific point in time or if it was a gradual thing? Or I'm sure you've probably thought about this from time to time.
Well, actually, no, that's a good question. I have thought about it. I began, since I was heavily involved, I worked from 1991 till 95, I worked for a company that Dr. Deming had founded to teach his philosophy and so forth. And I crisscrossed the country working with companies that were adopting his philosophy. And one of the things that I began to see as the 90s kind of wore on was that the companies that were going to do it and get serious about it had pretty much done it. And other companies were looking at it and saying, well, you know, business is pretty good. You know, the early 90s, mid-90s, the economy was booming. We were doing well. There was no notion that you had to do anything special.
Uh-huh.
I think the other thing that you saw happening, and this starts in the late 80s, is a real movement in corporate America to even greater than ever focus on the shareholder and Wall Street and the Wall Street analyst prediction. If you remember that film, Wall Street, Douglas stands up before the shareholders and says, you know, greed is good.
Uh-huh.
Well, this is a movie that simply reflected what was going on. There was a time when no self-respecting CEO would stand up and say, I'm in business to make the shareholders wealthy.
Uh-huh.
They would say, I'm trying to produce a product, I'm here to serve the customer, that I'm doing something useful, but that has all gone away now, and nobody seems to have any chagrin at all about saying it's all about stock over value. And that, coupled with the booming times, kind of led to, well, we don't really need that anymore.
Yeah.
So there was a positive thing going on, and this was the real evolution of Six Sigma. Six Sigma started at Motorola, which was one of the first Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award winners. It had adopted Deming's philosophy. It had pushed it through the entire organization. And they had kind of bumped it up and taken it, as I said, to that next level of sophistication and put it through their worldwide operations and really committed to quality. And as they got more traction with it and got more publicity, if you will, about that, GE signed on to it. Jack Welch caught on to the notion of Six Sigma, and he said, well, this is cool stuff. We're going to do it, and I'm committed to it.
Uh-huh.
So GE now picked it up, and if you know anything about Jack Welch, he was nothing if not an evangelist.
Yeah.
And so he was out there preaching the Six Sigma, so many, many companies adopted it. And there grew up this myth that this was something brand new, never been done before, had nothing to do with TQM, et cetera, et cetera. And I saw many, many articles. In fact, there's a well-known, unmentionable authority in Six Sigma who is constantly railing about this has nothing to do with TQM. And, of course, that's utter nonsense.
Uh-huh.
What is Six Sigma? It is based on these statistical notion from statistical process control of creating any product or service at a level of Six Sigma, which means 3.4 defects per million opportunities. So since many of your listeners are in the software world, that means 3.4 defects per million lines of code.
And that would be astoundingly low for software these days, wouldn't it?
It would be. And in fact, one of the problems, and you know, we started out talking about this, is that since people have forgotten Deming and have forgotten that you can take all of these principles and apply them in the software world,
uh-huh.
we're getting worse
uh-huh.
at software. Worse.
It's amazing, isn't it?
We lose worldwide. The world economy loses over $500 billion every year in failed software projects. Now, those are the ones that fail completely.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't count all the millions of projects that simply limp along and have massive maintenance involved in them. But, it's pretty grim out there.
The thing that you mentioned about, you know, Six Sigma and GE and people that adopted that, to me, the thing that I think we lose the idea of is why the Japanese, in the rebuilding years after World War II and in learning how to manufacture things better, why they embraced this. And, of course, you remember this time, and I remember it because I was a child of the 60s, but there was a time when, you know, you turn something over and you see it said made in Japan, and instantly you think junk.
Absolutely.
And it was true. I mean, it was, typically it was something that was cheap and would fall apart and break. And it's rather amazing to think that in probably 20 years or less, that reality went from junk to quality. And so there was a motivation, I think, in the business realm, wasn't there? I mean, Deming wasn't just out doing this for the goodness of quality itself, was he?
Absolutely not. And, you know, one of the things that he told those Japanese executives when he met with them was, if you really want to rebuild your industry, if you really want to rebuild your country, rebuild your economy, this is how you're going to do it. And his notion was kind of almost borderless understanding of how important this is to every country.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, he preached the same message here in the U.S., and until 1980, didn't have much success getting through to people. And, again, the companies that picked up on it did start seeing that progress, turn themselves around.
Uh-huh.
Xerox was down to, I think, I can't remember, but it was in the, around, let's say, somewhere between 7 and 17% market share.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they were in deep trouble after being, of course, the leader when they adopted this, and, of course, they came roaring back. Motorola had lost its Quasar TV unit to a Japanese manufacturer. It was a big discussion of, well, do you need to adopt this unless you're about to go into bankruptcy or out of business? And, of course, you know, Deming's famous reply to that was success is not necessary.
Right.
you can fail if you want to. Go right ahead.
Exactly. Yeah, and you know, to me, the automobile industry was the classic tipping point there because, you know, people in the U.S., auto companies, they felt like people would buy U.S. products simply because they were made in the USA, regardless of the fact that the U.S. models would run for 50,000 miles and the Japanese models would run for 100,000 miles. And I think they kind of got a slap on the head with reality there, you know, that consumers are going to buy what's the best value for them.
And remember, they had also, by this time, they had invented planned obsolescence.
Oh, yeah, that was, and still, people are still doing it. Yeah, that's what amazes me.
Well, look at Ford. Ford is the perfect example of what happens when executive leadership seizes on this stuff and does it,
uh-huh.
and when they take their eye off the ball. As when Ford and the leader at Ford, Peterson at the time, when he adapted this and he drove quality job one down through the Ford organization, and Ford came back.
Uh-huh.
Ford came back from the verge. Look what happened. Peterson leaves. New leadership takes over. They dump this. They go back to their nasty old ways. And Ford is in deep trouble today.
Uh-huh.
Deep
uh-huh.
trouble. And as are the other manufacturers. And look who's now worldwide number one in the world. Toyota.
Right.
Not GM. Toyota.
Yep.
And so it's a pretty straightforward story. You either do this stuff and you commit to it and you get the results, or you continue to focus someplace else and you don't. I remember along in that period, IBM came out with this notion of the year of the customer.
Uh-huh.
This is at the point when IBM was about to depart from this land because they missed out on the PC revolution.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, quality people said, wait a minute, every year should be the year of the customer.
Uh-huh.
Why are we in business? And Deming was very clear about this. We're there to provide value for the customer. And if you do that, everything else falls into place.
Yep.
Stock prices fall into place. Everything else, uh-huh. Takes on its proper place.
Absolutely. And, to me, I guess probably the best thing a company could do for its marketing department is to actually make products that work, right?
That would be a change.
Yeah. There was this whole philosophy that I think a lot of companies still embrace. I think one thing I noticed was a point of transition was when the mindset went from let's do it right to, well, let's do something and get it out there and then make it better later. That mindset was prevalent with the onset of the web, I think, and still out there. And although I can see the business motivations of capturing early market share, I think we have probably paid a price for that.
We pay a huge price, and that's
yeah.
what I was mentioning before. I mean, that $500 billion, that billion with a B, in failed software projects.
Yeah, you were talking about
hurt.
It does, and you were talking about the, what was it,
3.4 defects from
defects per million,
and we're nowhere near that.
Yeah,
in fact,
we're probably closer to that per line of code, or maybe per thousand lines of code. But we're so far away, it's not even funny. Well, Rebecca, we've been talking about a lot of philosophical things here. Say you're sitting across the table from a person today, maybe they're a younger person on a test team or maybe even on a development team or something, and they're trying to figure out ways to maybe get this point across to someone in their organization. Do you have any little suggestions or gems of knowledge to maybe help get help? I hate to call it even the quality message because, us in this business, we say the quality word and it just kind of goes an inch and flops. But
that's it.
But how do you generally give people guidance on how to maybe transform their companies? I know you said we can't do it from our little corner of the world, but how do you get the message out there?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. And one is you've got to get through the clutter and think about, what is management up above us in the company interested in? Well, they're interested in the bottom line. It's dollars and cents. It's cost. It's productivity. And those are the things that they're looking at today. So let's look at those things. And what I often have people do, especially testers have a unique position because they know where all the dead dogs are buried. They know how bad stuff is. I mean, is that not true?
That's very true.
And so what I say, if you're using a test tool for easy ways, or if you're using one of the big test tools, you've got some sort of defect tracker.
Uh-huh.
Well, go in there and take those defects that you've recorded over the year, and look at, I like to take about a year's worth of data. And I said, first of all, let's see, when in the life cycle did we find those defects? And, of course, the vast majority of them we find during testing. But a few of them crop up and get in there early. We find them sometimes through earlier reviews and so forth. But whatever, I've got all these defects, and now I know when I found them. I don't necessarily know where they were created. I might guess at it, but we usually guess wrong. But if at least I know where we found them. We found them during testing. We found them during coding. We found them during design, whatever. And then I go back and I apply some formulas from Barry Beam, who did the classic study on the cost of defects. And everybody's probably seen this in some seminar or another.
Uh-huh.
It showed that when you set out in requirements, it costs you, relatively speaking, a dollar for every defect to find and fix it. By the time you get into production, it's $1,000 for defects.
Uh-huh.
So you take some of his formulas and you apply it to what you've got. And in terms of defects and ways on them, and that gives you a good rough estimate, fairly conservative, but nonetheless usable estimate of what these defects are costing you.
Uh-huh.
And then you can go to management and say, here's what it's costing us. Let's look at this in terms of our budget. Is this an acceptable cost? And if it isn't, here are some things we could do to improve our processes, to change the way we're doing things, and here is where we will get the return on that investment. Here's what we will be able to, how we will be able to reduce it. And I'll just give you a quick example. I worked at a company a couple years ago, and we did this, and what we found was that a year's worth of defects, they had their defect tracker, came out to $14 million. Now, this was out of a $30 million budget.
Wow.
And by the way, that 30 to 35% of the budget is pretty typical.
Yeah.
Studies in IT, and you know, this shows somewhere between 30 and 70% of the IT budget really goes down the tubes.
Right. And by the way, that is one of the, I think, one of the most important metrics you can capture is that cost of rework, cost of quality kind of metric.
That's right. And it's so easy to get today. I mean, especially since people are using all these automated test tools
that
have all the stuff in their tracker.
Yeah.
If you don't, just start recording them in a spreadsheet. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Back of the envelope will do is if you gather that data. Because you got to show management. And in this particular company, we went and we talked to upper management. And we said, listen, this past year, you had a $30 million budget. $14 million of it went down the drain in the cost of finding and fixing defects.
Uh-huh.
Here are some basic processes and procedures that you could put in yourself, and it didn't require a humongoid investment. I think the overall investment was going to be somewhere around a couple of $100,000 over a period of a year. Within the first year, you can get $5 million of that back. And here's, you know, some of the details. And they just found out that their budget was going to be capped at the $30 million level for the next year. So I said, you're $5 million ahead of the game.
There you go.
You'll have $5 million more next year than you have this year, just because, even with a capped budget, just because you've stopped the flow of defects.
Uh-huh.
It's like you bound up the wound.
Yep.
And, of course, then so it's pretty good, pretty simple. You know, the first one of these ever I ever did. Company I was working in, I had a real job in those days. I went in and I asked the CIO, I said, would you like another $1 million in the budget next year? And I showed him the same thing. This is what the defects are currently costing us. Investment of $40,000. Is this good ROI? Spend $40,000, get back $1 million. Well, you know his answer.
Yeah.
That's
awesome.
This is why testers have such an inside track on being able to do this and so much power, because they're right there. They know the defects. They know what they are. They know the trends. They know the ones that are showing up day in and day out. In fact, that's why they get a reputation as being a great tester.
Uh-huh.
They know exactly where to go in and find this nonsense.
Yeah. Well, the thing I love about that example, Rebecca, was that, or the things, actually, were that you were dealing with hard data.
Yeah.
You're measuring things. You were making it relevant to the people that you were trying to communicate it to. You know, I love the line, you know, how would you like to have an extra $1 million in your budget? I mean, when you tell people, I can save you money, maybe doesn't resonate quite as well as would you like to have the extra money. And third, you're coming to them with not only the problem, but with the solution. And I think that's a great approach.
And in fact, that was what was so interesting, is that one of the guys who was head of the testing unit, he went in to the executive vice president's office himself to make the final piece of the presentation.
Uh-huh.
And he started his presentation with exactly those words that I thought he would say. He said, sir, madam, whatever it was, would you like an extra $5 million in the budget next year? I mean, you get their attention like that.
In a hurry, and especially today, as we're recording this podcast, where there's so many concerns about the economy, you know, that it's at the front of a lot of companies' minds. I mean, that's another thing, too, going on in the 90s, too. You know, there was a good deal of money, at least seemingly, floating around there, and people... and especially even more troublesome in the government sector, you know, sometimes I go in and talk about saving money and they say, why? And I say, because it's mine, that's why. But anyway, that's another topic. But Rebecca, I guess we're going to have to bring this to a close. I really do appreciate your time. Anything else you'd like to say before we finish? And then I'm going to tell people how they can get in touch with you, or maybe if you just want to tell them how they can get in touch with you. Anything else you'd like to say?
Well, yes. I guess if I could prevail on you to do anything, it's really to adopt the basic Deming philosophy of continuous improvement, planning what you do, going back after you've executed, and looking at the results to see if they match what you planned, and if not, looking to act, how can I improve this, how can I change this. The outcome will never be any better than the process that produces it. So if I have a flawed process for testing, I know that right away because I find defects in production.
Uh-huh.
That is my metric as a tester. For how good is my testing process? Now, I didn't create those. They occurred before I got to the table here. But
uh-huh.
if I am not finding every single defect before it makes it into production, then that tells me our testing processes aren't uh-huh. what they need to be. And I guess that's what I'd like to impress on people. This stuff is in your own self-interest. It will make you more productive. It will make you more effective. And at the end of the day,
uh-huh.
you're going to be judged on your results. And your results better be no defects in production, or somebody will come to you and say, why didn't you find it?
Exactly. Well, that's a good word, and I'll ask you one other thing. What's your favorite book or resource on Dr. Deming? Was it one that he had written, or is one that was written about him? What's the first one that you'd recommend to someone?
I would say Mary Walton's The Deming Management Method.
Uh-huh.
It's the best thing, and it's out on paper. I've seen it in the bookstores.
Uh-huh.
It's probably the best thing that explains his entire theory. Deming was not what I would call an entertaining writer.
That's true. But I did like Out of the Crisis. I did like it, but you still, it's a big book.
It was in spite of his writing style.
Exactly. It's a classic.
You read it because it was Deming, not because
absolutely.
It was do anything to put you to sleep. But Mary Walton's The Deming Management Method gives you the best explanation that anybody has actually written.
Okay, super. And to the listeners, yes. one of the best resources that I found to actually find some of these books, especially the ones that have been out for a while, is abebooks.com. They basically, thousands of used booksellers around the country, in fact around the world, have their inventories out on ABE books. And they, you know, many times you can get some of these books for $1 plus the $4 shipping, and it's a fantastic resource even compared to Amazon.
That's great.
Yeah, it's a great resource. Well, Rebecca,
I'll tell you how to get in touch with you.
Yes, how can people get in touch with you best?
The easiest thing is just to go right to my website, which is Advantage Leadership, all one word squashed together. www.advantageleadership.com.
All right. And there's a contact button there, and they can get in touch with you right there. Okay, super. Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it, and I know that our listeners have learned a lot from what you have to say about Dr. Deming and his work.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for giving me the chance, Randy. I always love a chance to talk about Dr. Deming.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Thanks for joining us today on this podcast. Thank you, Dr. Rebecca, for joining us today in the interview segment. Don't forget, plenty of resources for software quality and software testing at my website, www.riceconsulting.com. Also, come by, check out my blog, all kinds of new postings out there at randallrice.blogspot.com. See you next time.